On Robinhood Radio, it's time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage. David is a multimedia journalist with an online column at themediabeat.com and has reported since 2012 for the PBS network, mainly on ethical issues. He is also the author of a memoir, A Question of Paternity, Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning November 15th, 2024. It's quite extraordinary how much, here at a full 10 days after Election Day, so many of the American mass media are still engaged in effort after fresh effort to come up with explanations for how the sweeping victory for Donald Trump could have happened. The atmosphere of bemused wonderment and, in many cases, angry incomprehension show little sign of dissipating anytime soon. That's in spite of how essentially uninformative and unhelpful all these different attempts at analysis can be, many of them fully contradictory of each other. I couldn't help but find that a tongue-in-cheek approach has worked much better. Best of all was the resident humorist among the Washington Post's many columnists, Alexandra Petrie. Her post-landslide column was headlined, "I'm the only one who knows what really went wrong with this campaign," meaning, of course, the Democrats' campaign. You almost didn't need to read the copy underneath that boastful headline, since the best joke lay in simply the writer's own job description as a jokester. But I'll tell you that one gem of a reason she gave for the Harris-Walz failure was, quote, "not enough texts and emails from the candidates." To her possibly greater credit, Petrie also, days before the vote, did some powerful skewering of her own paper's top management and ownership, who decided unusually not to back any side in the contest. She chose to step into the vacuum and struck a rather heroic stance. "It has," she wrote, "fallen to me, the humor columnist, to endorse Harris for president." The predominant feeling of shock among so much of the mainstream media was also in a way foreshadowed by an illustrative piece of history writing provided before the vote by that other national beacon of liberal journalism, the New York Times. It too had a ring of media self-criticism. It was a piece by the paper's in-house historian, David Dunlap, who's a dear friend of mine, I should say, in the spirit of full disclosure. He brought to public view for the first time the special edition of the Times that had been planned and set up in type for the expected triumph in 2016's election going to Hillary Clinton, with several weighty articles analyzing aspects of her success gathered around a big, grey, empty square intended to accommodate a victorious Clinton photograph, which of course never arrived. The simple, evocative headline above it all was "Madam President." Extra poignant now, perhaps, in retrospect. Of course, newspapers and other media outlets have always been prepared, often in very great detail, for big historic events that may or may not happen. How could we do otherwise, in practical terms? But it's very telling that in 2016, no such special edition was prepared for the eventuality that did happen, the Trump win. This time, in 2024, the Times was well queued up with a front page ready for either candidate to win, and indeed for a possible tight deadlock, too. But since that tumultuous night, the Times has been as full as all the other media with its puzzled-sounding extended Monday morning quarterbacking, extended, as I say, through a full 10 days now. The baleful facts of the matter that so many commentators evidently don't want to see or confront was that Trump won decisively, and across so many different demographics that it blew apart a lot of fondly cherished beliefs. One of the frequently voiced appeals against the bigotry and cruelty of Trump's rhetoric, and his actions too, we should remember, from when he was previously in office, took the form of that proud complaint from Democrats, "This is not who we Americans are." The brutal truth is that this is exactly what many Americans are, enough indeed to win a majority of the popular vote, as well as railroading a whopping domination of the Electoral College vote. Yes, this is what Americans are. And even the most idealistic of us, even those isolated in our information bubbles and echo chambers, will probably know more than a few such Americans. They're a lot bigger, a lot more numerous, than the caricatured trope of the grumpy, prejudiced uncle who has to be pussyfooted around at our Thanksgiving table. I have my own telling memories of the 2016 convulsion. Not a single one of my black friends was at all surprised at the Trump victory. In fact, many had voiced confident, if sour, predictions that it would indeed happen. I myself wrote a perhaps oversimplistic phrase that Trump's chances of winning back then depended entirely on, I quote, how many angry slash fearful white men are out there, and whether they'll vote. I think that notion still applied, or came back again, in 2024, with the added rider of angry slash fearful Latino men, as well as some, though many fewer, angry slash fearful black men, too. It's not too simplistic, as we constantly hear about the Democrats' postmorteming, to consider carefully the redolence of that determined battle cry slogan from Kamala Harris, "We are not going back," which referenced not just the vital abortion issue, of course, but also the threat to women's rights considered more broadly. It earned a high-volume response. We need to recognize how loud and blunt a retort it could trigger from retrogressive white males. And we now know how much that same reaction was echoed among Latinos. Ruben Bonilla, a former leader of the League of United Latin American Citizens, known to reporters as possibly the most conservative of Latino groups, made a simple assessment. Hispanic men were reluctant to vote for a woman. It's almost a throwback. I would question only the word almost. For throwback, it certainly was. The utterly gendered nature of the overall result, right across different ethnicities, was clear the day after we voted. Men preferred Trump, 55% to 42%. Women favored Harris, 53% to 45%. Almost an exact opposite mirror image of each other. And Trump's men won. There was a time back in the 20th century when women who ruled countries were an extreme rarity. For a long time, there was only Sirimavo Bandaranaike in the island nation of Sri Lanka. But then along came Indira Gandhi in India, and even in stuffy old tradition-bound Britain, there was Margaret Thatcher. And in time, a steady sprinkling of female leaders in Europe and Latin America, Africa and Australasia. It's horribly ironic that the supposedly global torchbearer of progress and freedom, the USA, has been so slow, no, simply resistant, to embrace female leadership. And younger American men have been prominent among the holdouts. That can seem a deep paradox, since pollsters have found them to be in the forefront of many progressive issues, and most ironically of all, perhaps, that includes abortion rights. But, and this is displayed most obviously in their role as a media audience, they belong all too comfortably in what these days is often called the manosphere, what we might have once dismissively labelled just an old-fashioned boys' club. The younger elements are picking up on their male elders' cussedness and amplifying it in the arenas in which they gather online, gaming networks and in the surging tsunami of podcasts. One clear indicator of this came from Trump's own close circle, when the winner called to the microphone during his victory speech to supporters another president, one called Dana White. He's the president of UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship franchise. White's exact quote is worth repeating in full. "I want to thank the Nelk boys, Aiden Ross, Theo Vaughn, Bussin' with the Boys." These, of course, were all podcasters and so-called influencers who gave their platforms over to Trump, some of whom display, shall we say, questionable political outlooks with misogyny and racism slopping around in erratic currents. And then White went on to say, "And last but not least, the mighty and powerful Joe Rogan. Trump, we might remember, kept one of his rallies in Michigan, waiting restively for him through 3 long hours so he could sit chewing the fat for those 3 hours with Joe Rogan, the one-time stand-up comedian and game show host who now numbers 18 million as his podcast listenership. 4/5 of them, we should note, are male, and more than half of these males are younger than 34. Many of them regard Trump more as an anti-hero rather than merely a villain. One self-proclaimed Rogan follower posted a grinning selfie in which his shirt proclaimed, "I voted for the convicted felon." It was early on that this year's campaign gained the nickname the podcast election, on analogy with the Kennedy versus Nixon contest of 1960 being labeled the first television election, and George W. Bush versus John Kerry in 2004 being called the first real internet election. I confess to having been a bit surprised myself by the sheer power, a greatly diversified, scattershot kind of power, of this mini-medium. It's been made clear as I've been sitting for interviews on podcast after podcast promoting my new memoir. They often have very niche audiences, but they're just as often vast, though maybe specialized, like the Road Dog Trucker Radio Network channel that I talked to this week. And it almost goes without saying that this was another audience that tilts significantly, but not exclusively, male. Harris, too, was courting the world of podcasts and influencers, though possibly not as assertively as Trump. As many media postmortems have been pointing out, she did decline an offer to appear with Joe Rogan. As the Democratic Party faces the inevitable process of adapting to being in opposition once again, given Trump's return to the White House, the world of media, too, the legacy media, as they're being called more than ever now, especially by victorious Trumpists, we'll also have to work out just what role to adopt in the next 4 years. There is talk across many newsrooms and opinion conference rooms that it's simply time again to lean into the self-confessed resistance mindset. Many practitioners will recall that such an approach was kind of successful in 2016 to 2020, in that it generated big ratings and sizable gains in subscriber bases. It paid off to be vigorously reporting on and calling out Trump and his administration. On the other hand, the message for the media in the thudding election results seems to be that the market for such content or programming based around Trump's inevitable outrageousness in office might well now have very considerably shrunk. But that, of course, can be no excuse for the press not doing its job to the utmost of holding the next president to full public account. That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.com.